The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Compassionate healthcare. The myriad flaws in our medical infrastructure come as no surprise to Megan O'Rourke, whose set of symptoms, which first presented in the late 1990s but went undiagnosed until 2014, often led her to anger and despair. But out of that dark place, she learned that the illness was not just my own. The silence around suffering was our society's pathology. Based on a decade of investigation, including interviews with a cohort of over 100 other patients, The Invisible Kingdom, Reimagining Chronic Illness, published by Riverhead, is both an examination of what ails medicine and a manifesto. I got sick the way Hemingway says you go broke, gradually and then suddenly, O'Rourke writes. Just after graduating Yale, she abruptly experienced hives, fatigue, brain fog, and night sweats. She was initiated into the first assembly of the differently unwell. But the symptoms ebbed for a while. In her mid-30s, while on vacation with her husband, she noticed a braille-like rash on her arm. Extensive lab workups indicated nothing was amiss. A couple of specialists suggested she see a psychiatrist. O'Rourke heard echoes of the hysteria judgments of the Victorian and Freudian eras, but she was determined to get to the bottom of what afflicted her. She Googled, dropped in on chat rooms, becoming a kind of expert on autoimmune disorders. Ultimately, she was diagnosed with Lyme disease and other conditions that had long festered under the radar, and found a team who customized a treatment plan for her. The Invisible Kingdom is a medical detective story with the drama and style of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. In her research for the book, O'Rourke found that what she'd gone through was not uncommon. Patients suffering from autoimmune disorders typically encounter a series of roadblocks, among them clinicians who don't listen to or believe them. So she set out to build a book that could act as a bridge between a person with chronic illness and the people around them, she told O Quarterly. She notes that medicine is at heart an ethical enterprise, not a mechanical one. Empathy, she concludes, is a prerequisite, especially as autoimmune disease cases soar. O'Rourke's book has ignited a necessary conversation, proving the pen to be as mighty as the stethoscope. The Soothsayer. Margaret Atwood is a visionary novelist, but as our new volume of essays, Burning Questions, published by Doubleday underscores, she also has an uncanny knack for foreseeing what will happen in reality. Books director Lee Haber wanted to know more about what drives Atwood's art and activism. Lee, you have a roving curiosity that's led you to investigate a variety of topics from a young age. What role does curiosity play in your work? Margaret, it's primary, though unlike the cat, it hasn't killed me yet. I spent a lot of my childhood in the woods, so resources were limited. No schools, movies, libraries, flush toilets, electricity, etc. But there were books of all kinds and many rotten logs. You never knew what might be in the books or under the logs. A newt? Anne Boleyn? I was also puzzled by some of the customs and attitudes civilized people displayed and why they sometimes thought or did what they did. Many untrue and unfair things, it seemed to me. I've just continued with the books and the logs and also the puzzlement. Maybe we write to explore what puzzles us. Lee. It seems as if you've been able to see ahead to what might happen if we close our eyes to the erosion of women's rights, climate change, and more. But that prescience hasn't demoralized or numbed you. How do you remain engaged, even enlivened? Margaret, I do hear a lot of understandable despair and gloom. Looking back, we can see huge injustices and unbelievably violent and horrible acts on a mass scale. But we can also see amazing acts of courage, steadfast efforts to assert what's true and just, and to try to combat tyrannies of many sorts. I'm old enough to have known resistance fighters from World War II and also people who strove in the 50s, 60s, 70s to address inequalities and injustices. If human beings don't try, we will inevitably fail. It's that simple. Though I do sometimes feel like old Beowulf tottering out to fight the dragon. What, again? Are you delusional? Don't you think you're too old for this? But so far, I've ended up saying, not quite yet. Lee, is it the artist's responsibility to speak truth to power? Margaret, once we start dictating to artists, we're in trouble. That said, all of us, artists included, respond to the conditions, challenges, and viewpoints of the present moment. Those now involve massive accumulations of wealth and power in the hands of the few, lying and misinformation on a gigantic scale, and attempts to erode democratic norms and to prevent further democratization while pushing back against rights, such as women's rights to their own bodies, that we thought were established. Still, let's not start telling artists what they must make art about. They'll figure it out. Lee, what is our most urgent problem now, and how can one person help? Margaret, the climate crisis is exacerbating all other problems, but for some solutions, take a look at Project Drawdown online. As for what a single individual can do, that would depend on who they are and how much disposable time and money they have. Many are close to the edge already, and if they've just been burned out, invaded, flooded, etc., they simply don't have extra bandwidth. I believe the answers will come from communities, people working together, and from changes in the way we live and from the new inventors and entrepreneurs who are springing up. Mushroom bricks, fabric made from algae, new energy systems, agricultural reforms. Once you start looking, there's a lot already happening. Will we, the human race, be in time? Let's find out. Be the change. Mesha Marin's day jobs are novelist and university professor, but she's just as passionate about her side gig teaching writing to the incarcerated. Suspenseful, Seductive, Perpetual West, published by Algonquin, unearths the secrets in a marriage as Alana searches for her missing husband, Alex, in a Mexico that challenges her fixed notions about love, language, and culture. Via Alana's odyssey, the novel probes deeper themes, from fluidity of desire to the rigidity of racism to familial bonds. There's a tang of rabble-rouser in Marin's storytelling, something she comes by honestly. The daughter of prison reform activists, she grew up in rural Alderson, West Virginia, home to the first federal prison for women, founded in 1927. Her father operated a nonprofit hospitality house for families and friends of the incarcerated. As a girl, Marin accompanied him to visit inmates cut off by friends and relations. Now an assistant professor of creative writing at Duke, Marin shares that her first teaching experiences were at homeless and domestic violence shelters and a state prison. Up until the pandemic prevented her from going in person, she taught writing workshops at the Federal Correctional Institution, Beckley, an all-male prison in West Virginia. There, she often gave her students 40 to 50 minutes of free writing time, which was frequently the sole quiet period in their days. From television shows, we get the idea that inmates spend a lot of time alone in cells, she says, when in fact they follow a super strict schedule starting at 5 a.m. Garrett Jackson, a former student of Marin's who is 6 months into a 2-year federal prison sentence, had been keeping a journal while incarcerated and began to yearn for a way to help his words flow in a rhythm that the prison environment seemed to be stunting. Enter Marin. Prisoners are not an instructor's typical student, Jackson says, but Miss Marin saw us as individuals with minds to be shaped and not for the uniform we wore. True, our minds were like rough stone, Jackson continues, but she helped us smooth the edges and improve our writing skills in a manner that helped those with writing talent blossom. And that challenge helped us find a creativity and spark of light our minds needed to put down on paper, our thoughts, feelings, hopes, and dreams. Jackson is now completing his doctorate, and Mesha Marin plans to continue to devote her time and talent to the people her father first advocated for as soon as she can. Trailblazers. The organizations we spotlight here are incubating change, opening doors and ushering in a new wave of artists. Cave Canem. In 1996, poets Toy Derricotte and Cornelius Eady created Cave Canem Foundation to provide space and support for Black poets. Since its founding, Cave Canem has counted among its fellows many of the era's most exceptional American poets, including Jericho Brown, Robin Cost Lewis, Morgan Parker, and Gregory Pardlow. Pulitzer Prize-winning alum Taihimba Jess describes his experience there this way. The group of poets I've met through Cave Canem forced me to challenge myself to make the very best poem I could on the page, to never stop until I was spent with the effort in mind and spirit. It's this kind of kinetic urgency that Cave Canem fellows feel in poetry workshops and at the many readings and events we sponsor throughout the year. The trail of books, poems, awards, and learning that Cave Canem has created leaves a legacy that has changed the face of American literature forever. Hedgebrook. Seattle philanthropist Nancy Nordoff founded this literary retreat in 1985. The Whidbey Island oasis she purchased as a working farm has hosted a global community of women writers who draw inspiration from the idyllic surroundings for highly sought-after writing residencies. A stay at Hedgebrook includes a cottage of one's own, instructions on how to build cozy fires, and nightly chef-prepared meals at the farmhouse for fellowship and community building. Since its founding, Hedgebrook has hosted nearly 2,000 writers, among them Eve Ensler, Gloria Steinem, and Natalie Bazile. Library of America. When it launched in 1982, Newsweek called Library of America the most important book publishing project in our nation's history. Among its initial board members were Eudora Welty and Robert Penn Warren. It was envisioned by literary critic Edmund Wilson, who feared that many works by America's best writers were out of print or hard to find and needed a concerted publishing effort to preserve them. The LOA editions encompass all periods and genres, classics, neglected masterpieces, and historically important documents and texts. Asian American Writers Workshop. The Asian American Writers Workshop was founded as a nonprofit in 1992, a venture whose idea came to life around a diner booth in New York City's East Village, to highlight and promote stories by Asian Americans. It accomplishes these goals through writing workshops, fellowships, a digital magazine, and a reading series featuring writers like Min Jin Lee, Amitav Ghosh, and Alexander Chi. Baldwin for the Arts. Baldwin for the Arts in upstate New York was founded by author Jacqueline Woodson after winning Sweden's Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award in 2018, an award that came with a substantial cash prize. She says, "I have a quilt square my friend Melanie Hope made for me. It says you have to give it away to keep it. I truly believe this. Without other artists in the world, I wouldn't be able to do my work. This money and the help of others allowed me to begin the work I had long dreamed of doing, creating a safe space for artists." Artists can apply for literature, music composition, and visual arts residencies, which are free. Woodson's hope is to give artists the gift of uninterrupted creative time. The end game, of course, is more great art, words, and music in the world. Our next article is titled Martha Beck's Three-Step Plan for Navigating the Rocky Road of Life. "What is happening to my life?" said Dorothy, exhaustedly sipping a triple espresso across the table from me. "Did I do something to deserve this?" By this, Dorothy meant a series of crises that had recently hit her like a gang of prize fighters. Her husband had filed for divorce a week after she lost her job, the same day she was diagnosed with diabetes. Then her best friend moved away. Now Dorothy was caring for both her aging parents while paying a divorce lawyer way more than she or her retirement account could afford. "I'm not sure I can go on," she told me. "Why is all this happening at once?" "Well," I said, "according to probability theory, random events can run in streaks. It's like pattern disorder, and in nature it creates beautiful things." Dorothy looked as though I'd poured mouse droppings into her coffee. "That's your explanation? My screwed up life is just beautifully random?" "It's the most rational explanation," I said. "It's not my explanation." "Well, what is?" I shrugged. "I think you've hit a rumble strip." Then I laid out for Dorothy what I'll now lay out for you, just in case your own current luck makes Job look like a lottery winner. I don't know why catastrophes sometimes come in clusters, but experience and observation have convinced me that these patches of awfulness may be purposeful and, in the end, benevolent, If you've had a run of horrible luck, you can tell yourself you're being tortured or punished, or you can decide you're being steered. Life is a highway. Imagine that your true self is your essential consciousness, the part of you that still feels what it was like to be you 10 years ago, even though most of the atoms in your physical body have been replaced since then. Suppose you set out to experience the adventure of human life by inhabiting your body, and that this essential you sees your life as an epic road trip. Destination, inner wisdom, love, and joy. Now let's suppose you forgot this destiny at birth. In its place, you created a mental map of the life route you preferred, passing through good health, perfect romance, and professional success on the way to a cheery, painless death, say being struck by a meteorite while bicycling at the age of 110. Unfortunately, your essential self very probably has in mind a stranger and more exciting road, featuring spooky tunnels, scary precipices, and sharp curves, which means your destiny isn't at all what you think you want. Which means that as you drive along the road of life, there will be times when your essential self plans to turn even though you most certainly do not. Behold the rumble strip. If you're paying attention to your environment, relaxing, and following the road, detours from your mental map may be unnerving, but not catastrophic. Maybe you plan to become a dentist and marry your high school boyfriend, only to realize that, one, you hate staring into other people's mouths, and two, you actually prefer women. So you quit dental school, break up with Mr. Wrong, and find work and love that suits your innate preferences. Or not. This is a best-case scenario, and such scenarios virtually never happen. What virtually always happens is that when destiny swerves, we proceed straight ahead. We step on the gas, ignoring the fact that we feel trapped in the dead relationship, stifled by the secure job. We go blind to the landscape and the road signs, steering by our assumptions about what life should be, as unaware of those assumptions as a sleeping driver is of her unconsciousness. And voila! Rumble strip. Suddenly, everything's shaking, jolting, falling apart. We have no idea what's happening or why, only that all hell is broken loose. It gets worse and worse until we wake up, see through our false assumptions to the deeper truth of our situation, and revise our life maps. This isn't punishment. It's enlightenment dressed as chaos. My rumble strip. I hit my first rumble strip while driving hell for leather toward my third Harvard degree. In 6 memorable months, I was almost killed in a car accident, in a high-rise fire, and by a violent autoimmune reaction to an accidental pregnancy. I had incessant nausea and fibromyalgia and lice. By the time the baby was diagnosed with Down syndrome, I was pretty much done for. It took all that to shatter my core assumption that achievement and intellect gave my life its value. Only after my world seemed to completely fall apart did I learn the lesson my true self needed me to learn, that no brass ring is worth a damn compared with the one thing that makes life worth living, love. Duh, you'd think I'd have figured that out earlier. There were signs absolutely everywhere, but until my first rumble strip shook me awake, I never even noticed them. I've had other streaks of awful luck since, but none has ever caused as much suffering. That's because I've developed a rumble strip coping strategy. If your own luck seems weirdly cursed, try this. Navigating rumble strips. Step 1, hit the brakes. When Dorothy told me over coffee that she wasn't sure she could go on, I secretly rejoiced. Not because I wanted her to suffer, but because I didn't. Yep, I said, trying not to sound smug. The rumble strip is telling you to stop. Stop what? Everything, I told her, except what's necessary to survive. Eat, sleep, go to the bathroom. Make sure your children, pets, and sick parents eat, sleep, and go to the bathroom. If that's beyond you, ask for help. Not forever, just for now. This time Dorothy looked as though I'd asked her to stab a baby panda, but she was too exhausted to argue. That was a good thing. When you feel so beaten down that you can't sustain normal activities, it's time to stop trying. Surrender, Dorothy. Step 2, put your mind in reverse. From a place of minimal functioning, you can back off the rumble strip by reversing the assumptions that steered you onto it in the first place. These key assumptions are clearly marked with intense negative emotions, fear, anger, sadness. Such feelings are big red wrong way signs. Back away from them. To help Dorothy do this, I asked her which of all her tribulations was causing her the most pain. Topping her very long list was the thought, my marriage has failed. So that's where we began shifting Dorothy's mind into reverse. Give me three reasons your marriage actually didn't fail, I said. But it did, Dorothy muffled a sob. Well, was any part of it good? Yes, of course. Did you learn from it? I learned so much, said Dorothy. And is every learning experience that comes to an end a failure, I asked, like school or childhood or life? Well, no. Dorothy paused, thinking. Then her shoulders relaxed just a little. Ta-da! She'd begun reversing a painful assumption. To be clear, I wasn't trying to minimize Dorothy's pain or plaster a creepy happy face over her legitimate sorrow. I only wanted her to alter her beliefs enough to catch a glimpse of a different road, where a marriage could succeed as a soul adventure even if it didn't last forever. Try throwing your mind into reverse right now. Think of the worst, most hurtful thing that's happening in your life. Now think of a way this horrible thing might be good. The more rigidly you hold on to your assumptions, the harder this process will be. But with practice, you'll improve, and trust me, it's so worth the effort. When life gets rumbly, being able to reverse an assumption turns out to be the handiest skill imaginable. Step 3. Find and follow smooth terrain. Because rumble strips are one of the few experiences that will make sensible people hire a life coach, I've been privy to hundreds of them. And I've noticed a very consistent pattern. At the point when someone sees through a false assumption, the road of life suddenly turns smooth. Instead of crazy bad luck, bits of strangely good luck start showing up. They're small at first, inconspicuous. Never mind, slather them with attention. Your attention is what steers your life, and it's much more pleasant to steer by focusing on the good stuff. In Dorothy's case, the moment she reversed her assumption that divorce always means failure, the waitress brought her a cupcake, said, on the house, and walked away. Later that afternoon, Dorothy found an abandoned New York Times unfolded to an article titled The Good Divorce, which helped and encouraged her. Then she ran into a former boyfriend she hadn't seen in years. During their brief interaction, he told her how much he still respected her and how valuable their failed relationship still was to him. Little miracles like this will begin happening to you whenever you turn toward your right life, even if you're in the middle of a rumble strip. If you stop everything you think you should be doing, surrender to what's actually happening, reverse your assumptions, and steer toward the glimmers of light that appear as your old beliefs shatter, the small miracles will turn into big ones. Eventually, your good luck will seem as incredible and mysterious as your bad. Once more, you'll be asking, "Did I do something to deserve this?" Only this time, the question will arise from a sense of overwhelming gratitude, not overwhelming pain. By the way, the answer to that question is yes. You did do something to deserve this. You had the courage to keep traveling the precarious road of life. You deserve to be guided and rewarded. And when all else fails, rumbled. Our next article by Hamilton Kane is titled, Jennifer Homans Shines a Miner's Light into the Secrets of Mr. B. With the advent of the holidays, crowds surge into concert halls for an evergreen enchantment. Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker, capped off by a towering Christmas tree and the delicate point work of the Sugar Plum Fairy. George Balanchine, one of the 20th century's magisterial choreographers, gravitated toward the Nutcracker as surely as a toddler reaches for a toy. His vision remains a cornerstone of the New York City Ballet's repertory to this day. Balanchine's childlike wonder and fleet-footed technique permeate Jennifer Homans' elegant biography, Mr. B, as she chronicles an odyssey from the blood-red sunset of Tsarist Russia to the hustle and hijinks of post-war New York. Homans, author of the celebrated Apollo's Angels, published in 2010, bores deep into her subject, shining a miner's light into the shadowed crevices where the secrets hide. Mr. B is a gorgeously written, intricate account. Here's his part angel himself, but mostly a slight, polite man with voracious appetites for dance, women, and cooking. Born George Balanchidvadze in St. Petersburg in 1904, he came of age amid tumult and transition. His father, Melitin, an accomplished composer, had been previously married in his native Georgia. His Russian mother, Maria, steered her daughter and two sons toward artistic pursuits. After Maria won the state lottery, a statistical rarity, the family divided their time between a luxurious apartment and a country house in. When his sister auditioned for the Imperial Ballet School, Balanchine tried out as well. He was selected while she was passed over. Holman scrupulously sifts through archives and interviews. Once Balanchine was packed off to boarding school, his ties to his family were largely severed. His parents and brother moved back to Georgia, while his sister perished during the Bolshevik Revolution. In Mr. B, they're distant and blurred, but integral to his formation as an artist. He kept a photograph of Melitin next to his bed throughout his life. In the aftermath of World War I, St. Petersburg was rechristened Leningrad, a charred shell of its former glory. Balanchine dodged bullets and foraged for rats before fleeing to Paris, accompanied by the first of his five wives. He joined Diaghilev's émigré ballet Russes as both dancer and instructor, absorbing, then transcending, the vocabulary of classical movement. He wrangled the steps to his own ends. Holman suggests Balanchine was always more invested in creating dances rather than seeking the limelight himself. His decade in Europe launched a trajectory that brought him to the United States in 1933, the beachhead for his future company. Holman's portrait of the choreographer's business partner, Lincoln Kirstein, a Jew and closeted homosexual ensconced in the Northeastern WASP establishment, is rich and resonant. Balanchine would have been unthinkable without Kirstein's unflagging support. Balanchine migrated between coasts, raking commissions from popular entertainment. Holman succinctly summarizes his philosophy. Simple songs to simple music. This is what he liked about Broadway and Hollywood. It was direct, clever, clear, no pretense, and he had serious and enduring admiration for Rodgers and Hart, the Gershwins, and Cole Porter. Their workmanlike approach was his approach, too. Just work, no drama, no fuss. For a man who drew from such deep emotional wells, he had remarkably little angst in the studio. There, he was unencumbered. He blended this method with explorations of Greek myths and abstract expressionism, opening the door to fresh interpretations and innovation. Not for him, the tired Russian forms. With the founding of the New York City Ballet, or NYCB, Balanchine hit his stride just as America flowered among the rubble of Western cultures. The early 1950s brought an outpouring of new dances, and the range from light to dark, from pleasure to beauty and pain, was impressive, Holman writes. We can see the NYCB repertory already had everything. Founding texts like Serenade, Apollo, Concerto, Barocco, The Four Temperaments, and Symphony in C, Firebird and Swan Lake, and soon The Nutcracker. The NYCB toured frequently, at home and abroad, even accepting an invitation to the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. Balanchine's politics were conservative and vehemently anti-communist, although he ran up against the walls of made-in-America institutions. In one pas de deux, he paired Arthur Mitchell, a black male dancer, with a white woman, Diana Adams, risking a public outcry. But as Holman notes, George said nothing, he just did it. Balanchine was nothing if not a woman's man. He was endlessly falling in love with his ballerinas, sometimes two or three at once. He occasionally married his muses, from the Norwegian Verna Zorina to Native American Maria Tallchief, to the fiery French-American Tanaquil Tanny Leclerc, crippled by polio in her prime. He channeled his zeal for his performers into the works he made for them, such as the groundbreaking Agon, 1957, set to a score by Stravinsky. Agon is a woman's world, Holman observes. The four men open and close the performance and have the first and last breath, but the eight women dominate. They are confident, even aggressive, and with the notable exception of the pas de deux, barely in need of male support. They are the source of the ballet's primal energy and self-assurance and of its humble grace. They are on point, but their toe shoes are not used to emphasize the ethereal and are instead made to dart into the floor, propel the body, mark time, extend the leg not up but down into the ground, weight slung low or precariously suspended. They are instruments of mathematical precision, of logic and calculation. Among his muses, Suzanne Farrell stood out. Her blazing talent caught his eye, and she rose rapidly through the ranks, starring in Quixote. His apparently unconsummated passion for Farrell triggered a depression when she married another company member, but he rebounded with 1973's Stravinsky Festival, a tour de force week of 31 ballets performed in memory of the composer and his musical mentor. As Balanchine aged into his 60s and 70s, his obsession with younger dancers, some teenagers, roiled his core. Holmans portrays the creepiness as the dark side of his creative drive. And yet in his later years, he churned out beautiful pieces. Violin concerto, symphony in three movements, and the arduous Ballo della Regina. For fans of Apollo's Angels, the magic is back as Holmans brings us into the sweat and strut of studio classes, the jumps and jolts of business deals, the hushed thrill of Manhattan theaters. Mr. B pirouettes and arabesques and clean lines, despite the rare wobble. She lavishes attention on lavish, for example. I counted over a dozen instances throughout the book. She struggles with unlocking her protagonist. He's somehow too light on his feet, but she leavens the biography with wry anecdotes and ravishing prose. Balanchine may have been a genius on an Olympian scale, but in Mr. B, he's relentlessly, alluringly human. Our next article by Wadzani Moot is titled 12 Surprising Facts We Learned About Zora Neale Hurston. 63 years ago, the world lost an indomitable force whose career is enviable and impact undeniable. In commemoration, PBS is airing a documentary called Zora Neale Hurston, Claiming a Space. The more you learn about Hurston, the more you realize how enigmatic and exceptional she was, succeeding at a time when options for poor black women were limited. "If you are silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it," said Hurston. Most readers know her famous books. Their Eyes Were Watching God, Dust Tracks on a Road, Barracoon, and Mules and Men, but here are a few surprising facts about this Guggenheim-winning author. Number 1. Hurston was born in Natsulga, Alabama in 1891, the fifth of eight children. When she was 3 years old, her Baptist preacher father moved the family to Eatonville, Florida. Established in 1887, it was the only all-black incorporated town founded by freedmen. John Hurston served 3 terms as mayor of the town. Number 2. The writer's mother died in 1904 when Hurston was 13, and John promptly remarried. Hurston, who had a tumultuous relationship with her stepmother, joined siblings in Jacksonville, Florida. She attended boarding school but was forced to leave when her father ceased tuition payments. Hurston was passed from relative to relative, working odd jobs until she secured employment as a maid for a singer in a Gilbert and Sullivan troupe, eventually landing in Maryland. Number 3. At 26, she subtracted 10 years off her age in order to attend Morgan Academy in Baltimore for free. Hurston graduated in 1918 and enrolled at Howard University. There, she co-founded a campus newspaper, The Hilltop, was part of a drama group, and wrote poems and short stories, including John Redding Goes to Sea, published in writer Alan Locke's literary magazine Stylus. After working as a waitress and attending school part-time, she graduated with an associate's degree, but due to lack of funds, could not proceed with her education. Number 4. Hurston moved to Harlem, where she quickly became a part of the New York literati, which included Langston Hughes, Jesse Redmond Fawcett, and County Colon, among others. In May 1925, she won 4 awards, the most at a literary awards dinner held by Opportunity magazine. There, she met author Fanny Hurst, who hired her as an assistant. Hurston also made an impression on Annie Nathan Meyer, a founder of Barnard College, who offered her admittance and a scholarship to continue studies. In 1928, Hurston became the school's first black graduate. Number five, at Barnard, the writer discovered an interest in anthropology. Her work received the attention of Frank Boas, known as the father of modern anthropology, who taught at Columbia University. After some field work in Harlem, Hurston ventured to the South, researching and collecting data on cultural practices in black communities. She secured a car loan, bought a pistol, and traveled alone until she chanced upon Langston Hughes in Alabama. Hughes assisted Hurston in her work, and together they returned to New York. Number six, philanthropist Charlotte Osgood Mason, a benefactor of Hughes's and other Harlem Renaissance artists, supported Hurston to return to the South under a one-year contract. It was during this trip that Hurston interviewed Cudjoe Lewis, one of the last slaves to land in the United States, on the Clotilda in 1860. Together with other formerly enslaved people, he founded African Town in Alabama. Hurston videotaped and interviewed Lewis. What resulted was the book Barracoon. Hurston rejected publishers' request to translate Lewis's dialect to standard English, and as a result, the book went unpublished until 2018. Number seven, traveling alone as a black woman in the South was a dangerous endeavor, in addition to the difficulty of gaining the community's trust. Hurston fabricated a criminal history of bootlegging in order to assuage the suspicions of male workers at a lumber camp in Polk County, Florida. She would also read Langston Hughes' poems to receptive audiences along her journeys. Number eight, funded by the Guggenheim Foundation, Hurston traveled to the West Indies to study Obeah practices. There she participated in four voodoo ceremonies, fully immersing herself in the religion and learning from its priests. Realizing the need to expand her research, she appealed to the foundation for more assistance and received a second fellowship. Number nine, in addition to the funded fieldwork, Hurston collected letters for a book on black love and documented dance songs and tales from the Bahamas. She also wrote the play The Great Day, which premiered on Broadway to great reviews in 1932. Number 10. In true Hurston grit, she won another scholarship, this time to pursue a PhD in anthropology at Columbia, but abandoned the program after a semester because she disagreed with the research direction the Rosenwald Foundation, which was funding her studies, insisted she take. Number 11. In a career spanning over 30 years, the prolific writer published four novels, an autobiography, two nonfiction books, short stories, plays, essays, and poems. Number 12. Hurston died in 1960, and her work languished in obscurity. In 1975, Alice Walker penned an essay for Miss magazine titled In Search of Zora Neale Hurston, which revived interest in the author and anthropologist's work and life. Hurston's statement, "I have the nerve to walk my own way, however hard, in my search for reality, rather than climb upon the rattling wagon of wishful illusions," fully encapsulates her life's mantra. She forged her own path, defying everyone's expectations but her own. Our next article by Alexis Benveneste is titled, Six Things You Need to Know About Psychedelics. Psychedelics such as LSD and mushrooms are expanding beyond their reputation as experimental social hallucination drugs. Often described as mind manifesting, because some believe they make the mind visible, these substances are becoming tools for medicine and therapy. MDMA and psilocybin in particular might become FDA approved as trauma treatments soon. In fact, the Biden administration said it anticipates that the drugs will be approved by regulators within the next 2 years. With this development, these mind-altering drugs are buzzier and more relevant than ever. So we're taking a look at six things you need to know about them. What exactly are we talking about? The classic psychedelic drugs, the ones you likely think of first, are compounds that have been used to produce non-ordinary states of consciousness, says Sharman Ghaznavi, MD, PhD, Associate Director of Massachusetts General Hospital's Center for the Neuroscience of Psychedelics. That includes LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, the substance found in peyote, and DMT, a major ingredient of ayahuasca. Along with these drugs, there is a class of psychedelics called empathogens. Ecstasy and Molly are the most commonly known drugs that fall under the empathogen umbrella. Ketamine, while not a psychedelic, is often grouped with these drugs because of its dissociative properties, meaning you might feel a sense of detachment from your surroundings when you take it. How can these be used as a therapeutic treatment? Both psilocybin and MDMA have received FDA breakthrough status, which means they've been labeled as drugs that can therapeutically treat a serious or life-threatening condition. This label from the FDA indicates that preliminary evidence points to the drug demonstrating a substantial improvement compared to other available therapies. For now, signing up for and participating in one of these trials is the most effective and only legal way to use psychedelic drugs in a therapeutic setting. Psilocybin was specifically given FDA breakthrough status for treatment-resistant depression. There are ongoing trials testing the drug's efficacy for depression treatment, including a Phase 3 trial that is set to begin soon. The Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research is invested in this discovery and potential breakthrough, committing $17 million of funding to expand research on psychedelics for illness and wellness. MDMA, on the other hand, has been given breakthrough status for its potential use in treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. A Phase 3 trial is currently underway to evaluate whether the drug can be effective in treating treatment-resistant PTSD. It could get approved as early as this year. David Hellerstein, MD, a researcher and professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center, is optimistic about these trials proceeding and eventually resulting in legalization for therapeutic use. Oftentimes, the people who participate in these trials fail to respond to several previous treatments, he points out, so legalization of psilocybin and MDMA for therapeutic use would be a massive development. It's definitely an active, effective drug for some percentage of people, he says. What are the risks associated with psychedelics? These drugs are not medically or federally approved, and psychedelics can have incredibly powerful and sometimes negative outcomes, especially in recreational and unsupervised settings. LSD and psilocybin have been labeled as illegal under United States federal law for more than 50 years, but they have been decriminalized in a few states and cities. The promising findings from clinical trials are under very controlled conditions with trained therapists and cannot be extrapolated to recreational settings, Hellerstein emphasizes. Often, bad psychedelic reactions or experiences are connected to using a high dose, which is why it's important to connect with an expert. Psychedelics are powerful drugs, and that means they have the potential for great good as well as great harm, Ghaznavi said. How do psychedelics affect your brain? When it comes to neuroscience, psychedelic drugs cause a massive discharge from transmitters in the brain, which can cause a reset of sorts for a lot of circuits, Hellerstein says. Popular psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin activate the serotonin receptors on brain cells in a way that reduces the energy needed for your brain to switch between different activity states, according to Weill Cornell Medicine researchers. You might feel like you're hearing colors or seeing sounds when the drugs kick in because a connection is being facilitated between brain regions that don't normally interact very much, Hellerstein points out. Along with these feelings, you might also feel sensations that seem real but actually do not exist. The effects can last long past one day. In fact, psilocybin treatment for major depression can be effective for up to a year for most patients, according to studies by Johns Hopkins Medicine researchers. What is the right way to take psychedelics? Given the fact that psychedelics are Schedule I drugs, which means they aren't currently accepted for medical use and have a high potential for abuse, Ghaznavi, as a psychiatrist, recommends that people use them only in the context of a controlled clinical trial. When it comes to treatment-related environments, the experience often begins with a therapist getting to know the patient. With psilocybin, for example, after the patient meets the therapist in an office, the next step involves receiving a dose of the drug in a capsule. For a fully immersive experience, the patient will listen to a curated playlist and wear an eye mask to promote focus. This whole process could last up to 8 hours. Who should and shouldn't consider treatment with psychedelics? There isn't a definitive. The people participating in the therapeutic trials underwent extensive screening before beginning the experimental treatment process, and they are being monitored very closely. People who have a personal history or family history of bipolar disorder or psychosis are currently being excluded from the clinical trials for psychedelic drug treatments, Ghaznavi says. Our next article by Amy Brill is titled, "Are All the Moms Microdosing Without Me?" One of my earliest memories is sitting on my mother's lap. It must have been around 1973, waving plumes of her true cigarette smoke out of my face. She was just over 40, a former career gal turned stay-at-home mom to my brother and me, with a whiskey and soda in her hand by 5 p.m. every day. It's been almost 50 years, I've got two kids of my own, and it is 5 o'clock somewhere, or so I tell myself as I pour a glass of wine and survey my domestic hellscape of laundry, deadlines, homework, and general anxiety about, say, the economy, politics, and what the heck we're going to do about the latest hurricane. What has changed is our mother's little helper. At least that's what I'm hearing from my parenting pals. Forget wine, forget gummies, try mushrooms. Not the $25 a pound at the farmer's market kind or the fix-everything functional kind. They mean teeny tiny doses of psychedelic mushrooms. The regimen, as those in the know call it, involves taking about a tenth of a regular dose, 100 to 300 milligrams of dried mushroom, on a steady basis, say one day on, 2 days off, for 4 to 8 weeks. And no, it's not supposed to make flowers talk in tongues or the clouds reveal your destiny, but it is said to improve mood, lower stress, and reduce anxiety. Everything looked bright and beautiful, but there was no hallucinating, a mom I'll call Diane reported. That underlying feeling of stress and agitation I had as a parent, it was gone. The more I heard, the more curious I got. My husband and I have just bought a house, moved to a new town, and enrolled a tween and a teen at new schools. It's been a lot. I feel the effects in my mind, body, and spirit. I feel beat up. Could microdosing help? What would it be like? Would the boxes all over my living room start talking to me, or would I just feel better? The movement to legalize psychedelics for medicinal use is robust and growing. Measures to decriminalize personal use are moving through the system in over a dozen states, though it's only actually legal in Oregon and Colorado. A handful of other municipalities have scattershot rules that cover buying spores, growing shrooms, taking them yourself, and selling them to others. And yet, moms all over the country who micro have found a whisper network of friends to supply them, as state law, not to mention science, catches up with what users swear is therapeutic and what indigenous people have known for millennia. Lisa, a mother of three in Colorado, was one of the first people I spoke with. When she turned 40 a couple of years ago, she found herself spiraling into depression and anxiety amid the demands of motherhood and the lingering effects of old trauma. A lot of women struggle with the same type of things, but we're already in situations where we have partners, kids, jobs, she said. We can't just leave like eat, pray, love, but I needed to find myself again. It took a few tries with different varieties and regimens, of which there are many, until she found a formula that worked. As a parent, I always felt like no one was happy. I wasn't doing anything right. I was anxious and worried about the world and the kids in the world. And it lifted after 3 to 4 weeks of being consistent with the microdosing. It brought the joy back into it for me. I heard a similar tale from Brooklyn-based artist and writer Kristen Clifford, the mother of two teenagers who was recently separated, in recovery from cancer, and suffering from depression and the side effects of antidepressants. In her case, an occasional macro dose of mushrooms, enough for the traditional hallucinatory trip, led her to try microdosing. The combo offered a way out of what seemed like a thicket of despair. "I think mushrooms help make me a better person," she mused. "If it helps me love and accept myself more, then it helps me be a better guide for my kids to love and accept themselves." Clifford, who grows her own mushrooms legally in another state, weighs, grinds, and encapsulates her own doses. Her approach is likely outside the wheelhouse of those of us who can't even keep their basil alive on the windowsill, But then again, if I could manage 18 hours of driving a week for travel soccer while writing a novel and providing 86 meals a week, even if some of them are bowls of Cheerios, maybe growing my own is in the realm of possibility. I'm definitely more present and enjoy my kids more, echoed Anna, a 41-year-old director who microdoses on a regular schedule, 4 days on, 3 days off. I'm able to self-regulate better and co-regulate with my kids, helping them calm down when they're upset, and I'm a little less critical of my wife. I used to be pissed off when we went on a hike and my little one fell asleep and I had to carry her, Anna recalled. But now I'm able to hold her and feel accepting, like she'll be 14 someday, I can just enjoy this. All this sounded great to me, but I was still dubious about side effects and long-term impact. Would I wake up one day and find myself wandering the streets of my new suburb, chatting up the neighbor's azaleas? I don't like saying psychedelics for all, psychiatrist Ellen Vora, MD, told me. And not just from a medical or legal standpoint, it's not the right agent for all brains. The presence of, say, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in your immediate family, for instance, can mean that psychedelics might do you more harm than good. Leah Liss, MD, a member of the American Psychiatric Association's Board of Trustees, who started a practice in the posh hamlet of Southampton, New York, exclusively for psychedelic therapy, is enthusiastic about the potential for psychedelics, but cautions against flying solo when it comes to these substances. As providers, she told me, we must be there for integration, the process of taking the insights gained while under the influence and weaving them into daily life. If people are working independently, I'd encourage them to find a psychedelic shaman in their community. I tried not to laugh. Should I Google shaman near me? Check Facebook Marketplace? See if I have a LinkedIn connection? Plus, calling yourself a shaman does not mean you're a shaman, a major hurdle for me, along with my concern about the potential for health repercussions down the line. At the micro level, psychedelics are unlikely to really cause a lot of harm, Liss said. You might decide you don't like it, it's not for you. After talking myself hoarse and weighing the risks and benefits, I turned to science. Last year, an off-cited study found that microdosing significantly increased a number of psychological measures, such as well-being and life satisfaction. Then I read on. Participants taking placebo also improved. There were no significant differences between the two groups. Wait, what? Placebo effect? I frantically emailed Robin Carhart-Harris, PhD, one of the study's co-authors, to ask about all the moms who told me microdosing made their lives better. Carhart-Harris has a doctorate in psychopharmacology, is a professor of neurology, psychiatry, and behavioral sciences at UCSF, and directs the psychedelics division at Neuroscape, UCSF's Translational Science Center. The man knows his way around a microdose. The placebo effect is potent, he sternly informed me. There is pretty good evidence that psychological assumptions, such as that we're on a drug when we're not, affect brain function. Was this the answer? Should I take pretend mushrooms? If I knew they were pretend, though, would the shrooms even work? The original idea with microdosing was that you should not feel any classic psychedelic effects, but still gain something in terms of improvements in well-being and mental functioning, Carhart-Harris added. Evidence supporting these ideas is currently weak. That settled it for me. I was afraid of breaking the law, I didn't know how to find a shaman, and the medical establishment still had questions about the efficacy of microdosing. Even so, Lisa's words stuck with me. Psychedelics, she said, helped her really be with my people, my family, to cherish them as the people they are and not be so caught up in the minutiae. We need to do what helps us cope and feel better and find joy. I'll raise a glass, or maybe one day a dose, to that. We'll end this week with a message from Oprah on the importance of wholeness. What a time we have had here in California. It's been so triggering because this past January was 5 years to the day that mudslides destroyed so many homes and took so many lives. And 5 years later, here we are, all asked to evacuate our homes again. All is better now, except for those still recovering. It has been quite the time. This is also a time when people start to think about new health, wellness practices they can adapt to live a better life at the start of another year. There is so much focus on wellness and well-being, it starts to feel like a game. Writer Elise Lonin suggests that we instead switch our focus to cultivating wholeness, something she defines as a personal quest to figure out what fulfills us. No exterior standards validate this. As she explains, wholeness requires us to put aside one's ego to allow something bigger to emerge, to move past self-obsession, self-optimization, to reconcile our relationship to the collective and the planet instead. I couldn't agree more. Years ago, for the second edition of Oh, the Oprah magazine, this would be around 23 years ago, I interviewed Jane Fonda. I was struck by how evolved she was. She said, "I'm no longer striving to be perfect because I know it's not attainable. I strive for wholeness." It was the first time I had heard that word used in that way. She said, "I want to be whole." That stayed with me. Understanding and achieving wholeness? I've got to say, it takes a lot of work. It's about tuning out all the chatter around you and being able to listen to the most important authority around you, and that's yourself. Then it's about releasing any notions of perfection because that is not the goal. Progress is the goal. Progress toward a space where you feel more whole and complete, letting every single step move you in the direction of your own race rather than trying to keep up with someone else. That stayed with me. Understanding and achieving wholeness? I've got to say, it takes a lot of work. It's about tuning out all the chatter around you and being able to listen to the most important authority around you, and that's yourself. Then it's about releasing any notions of perfection because that is not the goal. Progress is the goal. Progress toward a space where you feel more whole and complete, letting every single step move you in the direction of your own race rather than trying to keep up with someone else. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.